This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. I'm here at the Ed Stone Radio Studio in England. Our panel of trumpet writers is ready to discuss the important events of this past week here at Ed Stone. In the studio with me, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
From our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
And back in our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Thanks for having me.
So the situation with North Korea continues to heat up. Last week on this program, The Week in Review, we reported on the long-range missile test that showed that North Korea can reach cities all over the United States. This week, the rhetoric between Pyongyang and Washington got considerably hotter. Some analysts are saying we are speeding toward a decisive point in what could end up being a nuclear conflagration. To learn about the latest developments, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded. Those were President Donald Trump's words on Friday, marking the third time this week that he suggested that he was ready to strike North Korea because of its illegal nuclear and missile programs and because of North Korea's threats to use those weapons against the U.S. The first of those statements was actually on Tuesday when President Trump said, he threatened to unleash, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen, end quote. So some really serious language there. And this comes as North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has specifically threatened to hit Guam, which is a small American territory in the Western Pacific, and it's home to a vital U.S. Air Force base. On Thursday, Kim Jong-un got very specific, saying North Korea would soon conduct a test firing four missiles into the waters near Guam. So all of this goes beyond typical saber rattling, and it does look like war is a possibility. And it's important to note that back on Saturday, President Trump won what was by far his biggest foreign policy victory of his first 200 days in office, and that was the United Nations Security Council unanimously voting to introduce a set of hard-hitting sanctions on North Korea that could cost Pyongyang billions of dollars. So for China and Russia to have signed on to these sanctions was very significant, partly because it shows that even these nations that try to work against the U.S. at every opportunity, they have serious concerns about the North Korean threat. So evidence of the growing fear over North Korea was also present in the global markets this week. The markets have been rattled by all these threats, and stocks fell quite a bit, especially on Wednesday and Thursday. Yet Rex Tillerson says there's nothing to worry about. He's the U.S. Secretary of State, and on Wednesday he said, quote, I think Americans should sleep well at night. End quote. And Tillerson did travel to Guam this week, maybe to demonstrate that he doesn't fear those North Korean threats. And then on Friday, China actually started to sort of sound like the adult in the room, telling North Korea through the Global Times newspaper that if North Korea keeps on threatening to strike the U.S. and keeps on testing its weapons, and then if the U.S. retaliates, then North Korea is on its own. China said it would not come to North Korea's aid in such a situation. But then the statement went on to say that if the U.S. were to strike first, then China would intervene. So the Global Times is not an official government mouthpiece, but it's very close. And especially in this case, it looks like these statements reflect official government policy in Beijing. China and North Korea are treaty allies. China's actually North Korea's only official ally. And back in 1961, they signed this Sino-North Korean Treaty of Friendship. And that does oblige China to intervene if North Korea is subject to unprovoked aggression. But if North Korea starts a war, then China would not. So this Global Times statement basically just reiterates the terms of that treaty there. So I think it's really interesting because basically China is telling the U.S. that if this test takes place, these four missiles are fired into the waters near Guam, then the U.S. can go ahead and unleash a military strike on North Korea and China would not intervene. So that's a pretty significant development there. And then meanwhile, Japan came out and said that the Japanese military is ready to protect Guam. The statement said Japan would shoot down any missiles before they could ever reach Guam. And that statement's significant for many reasons, mostly because this kind of thing would have been illegal for Japan just a year or so ago. But since Japan has recently reinterpreted its pacifist constitution, it's now allowed to use its military not just to protect itself, but also to help its allies. So anyway, that's just one other aspect of this really complex arena there in Asia, all centering on North Korea's belligerence. And there's a lot of brinkmanship here, many threats and counter threats, and there's no assurance that we're dealing with rational actors there in North Korea. So the typical international relations rule book and analysis may not be of that much value in trying to figure out what could happen next. But it all does seem to be sliding away from the status quo. And it looks to me like the status quo will not be maintained, whether it ends in war or maybe in some kind of a deal being made. It's hard to say, but it's clear that war with North Korea is now more likely than it ever was under Presidents Obama or Bush.
Well, there's a lot there to talk about. Just thinking about how, say, you talked about just the rational actor kind of analysis that you would typically take to a situation like this. And really, in a lot of ways, I think it is fair, as crazy as Kim Jong-un is, it is fair to, it seems to me like there's a certain amount of him trying to preserve his regime and looking at the way that he has conducted himself over the last several years, you can see his effort to essentially elevate the status of his country relative to the rest of the world and to preserve his own regime as being pretty consistent. And George Friedman this week that was talking about just how once they actually test or once they actually use a nuclear weapon, then suddenly he goes from a potential threat that others have to negotiate with and take seriously to essentially a big target. And it would really very quickly mark the end of his regime. So it is interesting just how far he's pushing this. I mean, it's certainly possible that he would do something that nobody would expect. At the same time, it's hard to see, and maybe this is probably Rex Tillerson's calculus, that he would actually risk the end of his regime over Guam. Or doing something that, say, if they did nuke a U.S. city, then suddenly the United States would have free reign to, you know, blot him out. It would be difficult maybe to take a preemptive strike against their nuclear installations. But it seems like even the way that China is reacting, that Japan is reacting, that would open up the door for the United States to have the fire and fury that Donald Trump is talking about.
It would be surprising, and it would certainly mark the end of the Kim dynasty were he to, you know, actually detonate a nuclear weapon on U.S. territory anywhere. So it would be shocking, and it would be illogical. That's true.
It's interesting looking at this in light of Bible prophecy. I wrote the Trumpet Brief yesterday about this new booklet that Gerald Fleury is putting out. Nuclear Armageddon is at the door, and certainly the proliferation of nuclear technology plays right into this pivotal prophecy that Jesus Christ put in Matthew 24, verses 21 to 22, that talk about the fact that we would come to a time where it would be possible to wipe out all human flesh from the earth. That's not going to happen absent nuclear weapons being deployed. So seeing this brinksmanship that we see in North Korea, it does point to that prophecy in a really direct way. And of course, you have the relationship between North Korea and Iran as well, where we've seen a lot of collusion between the two, and Iran also basically difficult to predict exactly how far it's willing to go using nuclear technology in ways that don't necessarily seem rational. It's just a very, very unstable situation. And in light of Christ's prophecy, it's easy to see how this certainly accelerates the timetable of that taking place in some way or other. Any thoughts from any of you gentlemen on how we might see this play out? Andrew, you wrote a little article basically saying it wouldn't preclude biblical prophecy for North Korea to actually drop some kind of a weapon on United States soil somewhere.
Right, yeah, because there many of the major news outlets, national interest, and other places are asking the question, is this going to be the start of World War III? And this is something that Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Flurry have proclaimed for decades, that Third World War does start from an Islamic superpower. Our Trumpet contributor Brad McDonald did a Trumpet Hour back in April talking about how this North Korean conflict is not going to start World War III. That's going to come from a Middle East conflict. But like I said, there's definitely a lot of damage that can be done to the world short of the next world war. And it is hard to see exactly how that would play out. So we do know prophetically that this isn't the start of World War III, but to see, like I said, a nuclear bomb detonated in some part of the Pacific or some Asian nation or as horrible as a place like Guam is something that a threat that policymakers definitely do have to be taking seriously.
Well, we'll have to move on from there. We appreciate that story, Jeremiah. Some interesting developments in Egypt. There, the president is trying to rehabilitate the nation's failing economy. But this involves taking some fairly drastic measures that aren't necessarily going to earn him any popularity contests. And he's not the most popular leader to begin with. To learn where this could lead, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
The Wall Street Journal had a very long and in-depth piece this week describing the situation in Egypt as it stands right now. It's not really a breaking story. It's one that's been going on for the past 6 months or even back into November of last year. You'll remember, people may remember that Egypt's economy was suffering. And in order to get a kickstart, it asked the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, for a $12 billion payout. And that's what they received under certain conditions. And one of the conditions that they gave was that Egypt's longstanding subsidy program, whereby subsidies are applied on a broad spectrum across most of the population on food and also gas, petrol, making that available to people, open slather, the IMF said that has to stop. And if you're going to get our money. And so Sisi for the past 6 months has been trying to really cut back on these subsidies, which again have been around since the end of the Second World War. And Anwar Sadat, going back into the early 70s, he tried to do away with them. There were riots. A dozen people were killed. Mubarak, he was wise. He didn't even attempt to get rid of the subsidies. Morsi actually tried, the Muslim Brotherhood leader back in 2012, he tried to reduce the subsidies, and then the people didn't like it, so he backed off. But now Sisi's trying it. And just because this is fundamentally a problem for their economy, if they're gonna say bread is 2 cents a loaf, or gas is, I don't know, 50 cents a gallon or even less, open slather for anyone that comes, then you have people on selling the gas, specifically the petrol, the petroleum products, onto people outside Egypt and within Egypt. To the point that it's really not helping their economy, because Egypt's government is basically paying for other people to get rich, certain individuals. So the IMF noticed that, and they said, okay, that's got to stop. So for the past 6 months, Sisi's done that, tried to stop it. And the result from that, and also floating the Egyptian currency, the currency overnight back in November lost half its value. Inflation right now, because of that, is about 30%. So not only do people have to buy things now that they didn't have to buy before, but now the money that they have isn't worth as much. And the goods that they want to buy, they're more expensive. So this is really hitting the low to middle income people inside Egypt. And it is worrying the leadership there.
So Sisi's really taking a pretty major gamble here and hoping that these steps that he's taking to try to correct the economy will, that the effects, the positive effects will kick in soon enough that it'll sort of save his political hide. But the risk is that he alienates the populace even more than he already has, and that this precipitates some kind of a convulsion politically within the country.
Yeah, that's the gamble. And this is what Yaroslav Trofimov wrote in this article in the Wall Street Journal. He said, as savings erode and consumer buying power shrinks, Mr. Sisi is betting that the expected payoff, which is new jobs, foreign investment and growth, will arrive before the economic pain risks another social explosion in Egypt. That was one of the reasons for the 2011 Arab Spring when Mubarak was left. It was because of it was a social unrest because of there was no economic gains for the people. That was part of it. And now it looks like we're suffering similar circumstances to that. There is another one of the moderate politician, moderate Islamist politician back in, he gave a quote for this article and he said this, the current stability is stability on the tip of a volcano that is on the verge of an explosion. When it will explode, no one can predict. And then he said, if that happens, it won't be a revolution carried out by the middle classes like in 2011. Under current circumstances, what I'm afraid of is chaos. And if chaos unfolds in Egypt, it'll be a threat not just to the Egyptians, but also to the whole region and to the West. So they're looking at this saying, hey, people are getting really upset. They can't afford things that they used to be able to afford. And for Egyptians, this does a lot of the time make them go to the streets. And that is a worry for Egyptian politics and the region. And it is something. The reason we're talking about this is because we expect still in Egypt a disaster like what happened in the Arab Spring in 2011. We expect different leadership to come in power once again, leadership that looks out for the little guy. That's what Morsi was planning on doing when he came in. That's what they're used to going back into the 60s in Nasser's days. He was a socialist that was all for these programs. And so it looks like the situation is set once again for a repeat of the Arab Spring. Depending on whether these economic gains come fast enough that Sisi wants.
Certainly something to keep our eyes on. We appreciate you putting that in context for us. Egypt, obviously a very crucial country in North Africa, in the Middle East, and in Bible prophecy. So we do appreciate that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Egypt isn't the only economy in trouble. There are concerning signs in Germany. We're going to take our next story to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, in a lot of ways, my story is fairly similar to what we just heard from Brent in terms of an economy under threat and the potential fallout for that. At the moment, Germany's economy is pretty good. And a big part of that is cars. I mean, we can all probably name a whole bunch of very well-known, very well-reputed German car brands. They're something that the Germans are quite proud of, but they're practically very important. Cars are Germany's number one export. They make up one-fifth of all of Germany's exports when you look at it by value. So, and when you take into account that Germany's economy is half exports, this is hugely important for Germany. One stat that kind of gets bandied around a lot in Germany is that one in seven jobs are in or related to the car industry. That's a bit of a stretch, they're still very significant. This is still very significant. And over the past few weeks, some things have developed that really put some big pressure on the car industry. They've been caught with some dodgy practices and are facing hundreds of billions of fines. I mean, the European Commission fine that they're looking at could be up to $500 billion alone. So in terms of the fines, they are accused of basically fiddling their emissions targets. They're accused of putting software, working with Bosch to put software in their cars that knows exactly what a test drive looks like. The software basically then would say, ah, I detect that I'm being put through a test drive and therefore deliberately engineering a certain outcome. And then when it's actually on the roads, doing something entirely different. So software deliberately designed to get around the test drive. That's beyond just kind of optimizing your engine so that it performs best when it's being put through a test. So that's what they've been caught doing by US regulators. Volkswagen got into trouble very famously for that in 2015. They were fined $20 billion. And you know, now America's looking at a much broader level of a level here. And then another investigation that's going on is coming from the European Commission. And here they're being investigated for basically forming a cartel. That a lot of these German car companies got together. They're faced with German antitrust or EU antitrust laws, price fixing, that kind of thing. And this is something the European Union takes extremely seriously. And their fines could be up to 10% of annual revenue. Not annual profits, annual revenue. And that's where this $500 billion potential, or half a trillion euros, so more than $500 billion potential fine. So you're looking at potential massive, and that's before you start to get into losses that the brand suffers, potentially fewer people buying their cars, bad reputation, that kind of thing. So you're talking about just a perhaps even existential threat to this major part of the German industry.
So out of all of the economic problems that we've been tracking across Europe, for the most part, we've had Germany, I mean, it was basically the strongest of a bad lot of economies across Europe. If it takes this kind of a hit to this major sector of its export economy, which is so crucial to Germany, what sort of ramifications are we talking about?
Yeah, economic slowdown and mass unemployment, especially if you look at what's going on with Eastern Europe. I mean, with Southern Europe. I think we're looking at one of two outcomes. One is yes, we're looking at massive fines hit, this kind of thing, potentially huge economic disruption. And you know, we've had Nicholas Frank here on the radio and in our studio saying, well, look at what Germany's like when they're prosperous. But if the economy starts to go bad, well, then
you're going to see a different German,
right? And yeah. And when you could see that happening, especially when you know there were more troubling news out of Deutsche Bank this week. There was more troubling news about their exports falling. So there is a picture building that looks like Germany is heading for a recession. So there's that. However, it wouldn't surprise me at all, and what I think is perhaps more likely is that we'll get another good look at the European Union's hypocrisy. That Germany, the German government is implicated up to their neck in both of these. The minimum is that they turned a blind eye to a lot of this, that it's kind of like, well, yeah, we get the sense that they're cheating on some of these things, they're working together, but they're our car companies, and we benefit when they do well, so we're just going to, you know, we'll look the other way. Right, exactly. And so what I think we could well see now is that at the European level, and you just start to see, you know, Greece breaks the rules, or some company in Greece breaks the rules, boom, you know, the European Commission comes out down on them, a ton of bricks, they get fines, this kind of thing. And I wouldn't surprise me at all that it was just with the political power that Germany has within the European Union, and if they're the potential, because of what's at stake, the pressure that the government may well bring to bear here, it wouldn't surprise me, at least within the European Union, if you see a slap on the wrist. Now, Germany could be, I mean, America could be a different deal, especially as you're seeing more and more antagonism between Germany and America, even the prospect of trade war between the two. You could well see this forming some of those, you know, kind of back and forth, tit for tat, both sides targeting each other's industries, and just part of the fallout between those two powers as well.
We'll definitely have to keep our eyes on that. We appreciate your analysis there, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Donald Trump has been president of the United States for 8 months now, nearly. And among all the problems he's faced, one of the biggest has been the steady stream of leaks coming from the White House, some of them very sensitive, some of them having some serious security implications. This is obviously an embarrassment to the Trump administration. But we're going to talk about how it's more than just embarrassing. The dangers posed by these leaks is what we'll hear about as we turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, in those 8 months, the number of leaks coming out from the White House has actually tripled compared to the previous administration, which poses a significant national security threat. And this is in the news this week because the former Secretary of Defense, Leanna Panetta, gave some comments to the press on Sunday just about how dangerous these leaks are. And just a couple days before that, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was on there saying how that he's the Justice Department is going to have to really start cracking down on, first of all, trying to find out who is leaking this information, and even raise the possibility of subpoenaing members of the media who are publishing these leaks, with the Washington Post and the New York Times seem to be the two main offenders for actually publishing the leaks for the world to see, even though we still don't know who their source is.
So, yeah, maybe you could give us an idea of some of the leaks that have actually jeopardized American security.
Right, because there's been a number of leaks just over the past several weeks. I mean, the most recent one was this Monday, where it was a global warming report from the EPA had leaked out early, which that wasn't something that necessarily jeopardized national security. But the week before, they had a leak of some of the phone call transcripts of President Trump's private conversations with the Prime Minister of Australia and the President of Mexico, which was more significant. And then going back to May, you actually had a couple really big leaks, where one with the some of the photographs of the Manchester attack in England were leaked to the U.S. media, which for a period of like 12 hours actually close down information sharing between the United States and Britain, as the British refused to give more information to the United States government. It was just going to end up in the Washington Post the next day.
Well, at this point, that's really the issue, isn't it? With the cooperation between nations in jeopardy, and foreign leaders who want to be able to speak freely to the U.S. president, basically fearing that everything that they might say in such a conversation could end up in the pages of American newspapers, they're going to really hedge their bets and be a lot more guarded. They could change their approach toward the president considerably.
Right, because there was also the pretty high-profile case with President Trump. He shared some information with the Russians on ISIS in Syria that he'd obtained from an Israeli spy. And, of course, as the president, if they're working with the Russians to fight ISIS, there's nothing wrong with him doing that. But someone in the room during that conversation leaked that to the Washington Post, or maybe it was the New York Times in that case, and that got out the next day, which, similar with the Britain case, is really almost, or at least had the potential of being a major strain between the United States and Israel. And that seems to be the biggest national security threat right now, is some of these things, like you're fighting ISIS in Syria and you're having these terrorist attacks in Europe, and we're trying to cooperate with those local governments to help horrible things like that from happening. And there is concern on can they actually share information with the United States if there's going to be an expose in the Washington Post or the New York Times within the week?
It does seem like you can't help but look at this as some people who are trying to embarrass Donald Trump personally are putting their vendetta against him over the interests of the country and, you know, America's ability to conduct its business on the world scene. Which it just shows a level of division and a level of kind of self-hatred within America that is really stunning. It's really on a level that we haven't seen before and very, very concerning. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a short break. Coming up, we'll talk about the police probe against Benjamin Netanyahu, Russia resurrecting an elite armored tank unit from the Second World War, Vietnam caving into China over a crucial issue in the South China Sea, and a showdown in the United States over sanctuary cities. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Benjamin Netanyahu has been a part of Israeli politics for 30 years. And many Israelis don't like him much, but they do respect him as a tough leader who's able to deal with the serious threats facing the Jewish state. Right now, though, Netanyahu's facing a tough test of his political survival as police undergo corruption probes against him. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so this has been going on for, I guess, over a week now. The Attorney General of Israel, he ordered a criminal investigation into Mr. Netanyahu for a couple of claims that he had accepted gifts for political favors, which is the main one. And the media blitz actually has been kind of amazing against Mr. Netanyahu. And I do watch a lot of Israeli news, and I was really struggling to find some organization that was going to be supportive apart from Israel Hayom, which is kind of a mouthpiece for the Netanyahu government in some ways. But everything else, from the Jerusalem Post, the Times of Israel, to obviously Haaretz, Ynet as well, all of the media have been coming down quite hard on Mr. Netanyahu and basically saying, you know, he should kind of resign already, not giving him the benefit of the doubt at all. And so what we've had this past week, a couple of days ago, I think it was two nights ago, Mr. Netanyahu actually gave a speech at a conference to some of his loyal followers, and he absolutely went off at the media in a way that is very much Trump-esque. And it just seemed that way, that if this was deserving, it's very much a correlation for what you see American media doing to Mr. Trump, what the Israeli media right now is doing to Mr. Netanyahu. And this is just one quote from that speech. He said, "The thought police in the media work full time to set the agenda, and woe to anyone who veers away from it. We know that the left and the media, and we know that's the same thing, is on an obsessive witch hunt against me and my family with the goal of achieving a coup against the government." So that's really strong, really, really strong words from Mr. Netanyahu against the left and against the media that he says are blowing these police probes. Again, nothing's been formed. There's been no indictment against him yet. But he's saying he's done nothing illegal, and yet he's saying it's a witch hunt against his family, what the media is doing.
So how unusual is this, Brent? Because we've obviously you're making comparisons with what's happening in the United States, and we've been seeing this, say, the way that the press responds to a Republican president building over quite a long time. Obviously, what's happening with Donald Trump seems unique just because of the way that he's lashing back at them. Israel, obviously a nation of very strong passions, but it seems like they're better at kind of rallying together against a common threat and just have a more realistic sense of the threats against them, which is how Netanyahu has been the longest lasting leader since Israel's founder, right? What we're seeing right here, how much of a departure is this from that?
It's interesting because you do have in Israel, everyone does express their displeasure for their leaders often, and yet when it comes to the ballot box, they vote for security, and that's why Mr. Netanyahu's got in power so many times. But I've never seen it this bad. I've never seen it as full on media onslaught against Mr. Netanyahu as what I'm seeing right now. Maybe it is a symptom of Israel's complacency, the public's complacency with their level of understanding of strategic threats that they're under right now. When he's elected, obviously it helps if there's a war on the horizon, be it with Hamas or Hezbollah, that helps Mr. Netanyahu. Or if Iran's, if you've got an Ahmadinejad in power, that's going to help Mr. Netanyahu. We haven't had an Ahmadinejad in power for a while. Maybe the Israeli public's kind of forgetting that. Said, I believe that you still have the firm majority of the Israeli public that would support Mr. Netanyahu. And what you're seeing out of the media is an outstretched opinion of him. You're seeing a loudspeaker phone belonging to a few people, and they're trumpeting that he's guilty, he needs to leave straight away, when the silent majority, I think, are pretty willing to have him there. Now, the charges that he's under aren't that serious. It's not like Olmert, who just got out of prison. The former prime minister of Israel got out of prison, I guess it was last month, after serving a 16-month term for corruption and bribery. This is simply a case of accepting a couple of cigars from a friend and some other business dealing that doesn't seem to be that much of a big deal. We're not talking about serious, serious complaints here. There's other people that say, hey, they've been trying to get Netanyahu for the past 19 years. If there was any shred of dirt, they would have got it already. So I don't think this is going to bring him down, although the media is doing the best job they can to try and do just that.
Well, I have to see what happens. Often these types of things do have pretty far-reaching political ramifications. So we do appreciate that, Brent. Russia is about to begin amassing troops for the biggest military exercise since the end of the Cold War, as many as 100,000 troops, according to the New York Times. This is provocative enough, but making it even more so is the addition of the 1st Guards Tank Army. This is an elite armored tank unit with an eyebrow-raising past. For this story, we're going to go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Russia bringing this tank unit back is... And there's no other the big reason for it is just to deliberately intimidate the countries of Eastern Europe. This was the unit that was created in 1942 that rolled across Eastern Europe, waited outside, well, at least would have been part of the Russian forces in the area that kind of waited outside of Warsaw for the Polish rebellion to be put down and then kept on coming. It was the same unit that was used to crush the uprising in Czechoslovakia in the late 1960s. So it's a unit that's got a lot of history of stamping on Eastern Europe and also stamping on Nazis, but on Eastern Europe as well. They've brought this back, and as General Breedlove, who used to serve as NATO commander, put it, that he said the name was chosen for a reason. It sends a very clear message to the Baltics and to Poland. And as a sign of just kind of the focus that Russia is putting on this 1st Guards tank unit, on this unit that's focused on Eastern, Central and Eastern Europe, is they're going to be the first armored unit to receive Russia's new T-14 tank. It's hard to say how good in reality that tank is going to be. On paper, though, it's pretty much the most advanced tank in the world. It wouldn't surprise me if it doesn't quite live up to that, but it's a very... No, it's a very impressive, very fearsome unit, and their tank, and they're going to get it first. So you're looking at a big focus on Eastern Europe from Russia, and that's got to give something, be something to give them pause for thought. And even just practically, it's getting to the point that Russia has more. They have about 800 tanks in the region. And that's more than NATO has in the Baltics, Poland, Germany combined, even including reinforcements from the US. So you've just got a very strong Russian presence in that region. And those countries have got to know if Russia invades, NATO's not going to stop them. It becomes, can or will NATO retake them? And can they trust NATO to, or rely on NATO to retake them?
Well, it's incredibly significant. We've been talking for years, and back to Gerald Fleury, when Russia invaded Georgia, just how much pressure Russia is putting on Europe and Eastern Europe because of the past that it's had and because of the threats that it has made, the cutting off fuel supplies, energy supplies, that type of thing. But this is one of the biggest forces that is forcing Europe to react and to unify militarily. And we've talked about how there are European countries that are essentially forming de facto European armies in order to counter this, and how this is driving Eastern European nations into the arms of the European unification project as a hedge against this type of provocation from Russia. Russia seems to really be savoring the opportunity to do this, don't they?
Yes, they do. I think they perhaps do the same thing that a lot of other people do. You look at the European Union, it looks like a bit of a joke. There are quite a lot of things that they do that's kind of ridiculous, and so they... I think they just kind of write it off and just think, okay, well, we can just bully these nations into getting our way. But I think, like we've talked about on this program before, you look at Poland and Germany, huge disagreements between the two. Lots of things the German government does that the Poles don't like. And yet, the two are still working together on significant military cooperation. And when you see things like the First Guards Tank Army, well, that's the answer to the reason why.
Very fascinating. We appreciate that, Richard. Well, it seems a whole lot of things have been going China's way as it has taken over the South China Sea. This week, it looks like another factor showed just how powerful China is becoming as Vietnam caved in over a crucial issue here. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Vietnam has a history of often standing up to China in pretty daring and admirable ways. But over the last couple of weeks, Vietnam has capitulated in a really humiliating way. And it reveals a lot about the changing dynamics in the South China Sea, especially regarding the power balance between China and the United States. This started all the way back in June when Vietnam decided to give permission to a company called Talisman Vietnam, which is a subsidiary of the Spanish energy company Repsol. And Vietnam gave them permission to drill for gas in the waters near the edge of Vietnam's exclusive economic zone in the South China Sea. And Vietnam was well within its rights to authorize this drilling. The United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea makes clear that this was a legal activity for Vietnam, but China wasn't happy about it. China apparently thinks that the Spratly Islands near this drilling location are entitled to their own exclusive economic zone, even though an international arbitration tribunal in The Hague specifically ruled otherwise last year in a landmark judgment. But China has little regard for international law that no one cares to enforce. So last month, China sent the vice chairman of the Central Military Commission to demand that Vietnam stop drilling. And when that didn't work, the Chinese leadership canceled a joint meeting with Vietnam about border security. And then when Vietnam still kept on drilling, China summoned the Vietnamese ambassador to Beijing to the Chinese foreign ministry and told him that if Vietnam didn't stop drilling and vow to never drill in that location again, then Beijing would take military action on some of Vietnam's military outposts in the South China Sea. And there are even rumors, though I was not able to confirm them, that a shooting incident took place on one of Vietnam's small outposts sometime in the last few weeks over this dispute. So if that was the case, it would represent a really serious warning from China to Vietnam. But in either case, China told Vietnam to cease this entirely legal drilling. And if Vietnam had had faith in the United States and in America's assurances that international law would be abided by, then Vietnam would have ignored China, and rightfully so. But instead, Vietnam bent the knee to Beijing. Vietnam's Politburo decided that the U.S. cannot be relied upon to come to Vietnam's assistance if a confrontation with China were to erupt, so they capitulated. The government ordered Talisman Vietnam, the drilling company, to pack up their rig and to clear out of the area. So I think it's just a really sobering indication of just how much influence the United States has lost in the South China Sea. How hard would it have been for the Trump administration early on in this conflict to issue a statement or two about the rules-based order and about the need for the nations of the world to obey the UN Convention on the Laws of the Sea? How hard would it have been for America to conduct a naval exercise near fire this Vietnamese drilling rig just to kind of remind China and Vietnam and everybody else that America's there and it's ready to keep things orderly. But there was nothing like that from the U.S., so Vietnam caved in to China.
It's amazing. China continues its march. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. In the United States, there is a real battle playing out between federal and state governments over the issue of sanctuary cities, exact lines of jurisdiction between federal and state. This has been a point of contention as long as the United States has been a country. But the rhetoric and the threats are heating up. Immigration is proving to be a serious fault line of division in America. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
That was a major campaign promise of the Trump administration, is to crack down on sanctuary cities. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions is now following through with those promises. With last month, he actually more notably made the announcement that the federal government will no longer be giving crime-fighting money to local authorities if they refuse to grant federal immigration officials access to their jails or refuse to notify federal immigration officials when someone who's wanted for deportation is arrested. And then finally, just last Friday, they sent out letters to four cities in particular, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Baltimore, Maryland, San Bernardino, California, and Stockton, California, giving them until August 18th to prove that they have policies in place that will grant those federal officials access to the jails to find out if any illegal immigrants who are wanted for deportation are in there. And if that they refuse to comply with it, this letter doesn't say they're going to cut existing crime-fighting funds, but they won't give them any more federal funds for crime-fighting.
So just looking at this legally, it seems like these states do seem to have some level of legal protection from the Trump administration making these kinds of threats against them. I guess the real question is how might this play out if the cities basically dig in their heels and say we're going to conduct immigration policy the way that we want, and the Trump administration threatens to remove funding. What happens next?
Right, because it's a federalization of police issue. The federal government can't force local police officers to help them enforce federal law, but they can definitely cut the funding. And in this case, there's a little bit of a legal dispute over whether Congress is going to have to rule on funding cuts. But the going forward is that even if Congress does back the president to cut funding, and these sanctuary cities still just accept the funding cuts and still refuse to help federal immigration officials, then the Trump administration is either going to have to just give up trying to deport criminals who are illegal aliens, or they're going to have to just hire a massive number of federal immigration agents to just do the work themselves.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eyes on this. The rule of law in the United States is certainly an issue that we follow closely, and seeing its deterioration is definitely a very concerning trend. We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com. The stories that we've talked about on the program today, looking back over the past week, we put those stories up on thetrumpet.com with all of the analysis that gives you this news in context. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour.
It's time for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention from this past week. We'll start with Brent.
The Palestinian leadership is currently extremely concerned over the nature of the Palestinian struggle in the eyes of the Palestinians, as it seems to have taken a more religious tone. A senior Palestinian official told our monitor, that it would bring, if this divulged into a religious war like it looks like it will, that, quote, it would bring Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran to the forefront of the armed struggle and endanger the pragmatic elements of the Palestinian leadership. So as Mr. Abbas hits 82, there are people worried that this religious war is going to open the door for Iranian leadership over the Palestinians.
And now to Richard.
French President Emmanuel Macron is making records with his fast-falling popularity. His popularity has now fallen the fastest of any French president since Jacques Chirac. They're down nearly 10%, according to one poll. And I think it just shows that France is not going to come charging in now and take the leadership of the European Union away from Germany on the wings of this new Napoleon, the way that some forecast. And while we're on the subject of opinion polls in Germany, Angela Merkel also had a bad opinion poll this week, showing that she was down 10%, but that she was still a favorite to come out as the next chancellor after the election.
All right, Jeremiah.
ISIS is in the Philippines. Islamists who pledged allegiance to the Islamic State captured the city of Malawi. The city used to be home to some quarter of a million people, but now it's a ghost town. The Philippine military has been bombing the city to destroy the Islamists and to try to retake the city there. And so far, 528 ISIS terrorists have been killed and 122 Philippine soldiers and some 45 civilians have also been killed in the crossfire.
Oh, that's a bloodbath. And we'll go to Andrew.
President Donald Trump announced that the opioid painkiller crisis is a national emergency yesterday. A drug commission led by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie recently noted that 142 people die from drug overdoses every day, which in his words, equal to September 11th every 3 weeks. According to the National Safety Council, 99% of doctors overprescribe opioid painkillers.
And back to Brent.
A high-level Hamas delegation arrived in Tehran on Friday in order to attend the inauguration of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and to, quote, turn a new page in bilateral relations between the two sides. During the meetings, they stayed there for the whole weekend. They met with Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif as well. And this is what he said. He said Iran was ready to put aside all the disagreements for the sake of supporting Palestine and the Palestinian people, as well as the unity of the Muslim world. And then he said the Palestinian issue remains a top foreign policy priority for Iran.
And Richard.
An 18-strong gang was convicted of 100 crimes in Newcastle this week. What makes them stand out is 17 members of these gangs are men, and they were largely people of Pakistani or Bangladeshi background. It comes after a whole string of stories where I think there's literally hundreds of Muslim men have been convicted of sexual assault on British girls. And it's a story that once again has got Britain talking about how these crimes were allowed to go on for so long in the name of tolerance, and that anyone who brought the subject up was very quickly accused of racism or Islamophobia.
And we'll finish with Jeremiah.
A Hong Kong-based newspaper published an article this week saying President Xi Jinping could name himself chairman of the Communist Party, and that this could mean he's planning to eliminate term limits in China. This is unconfirmed at this point, but this is also a very reliable paper. And in recent weeks, Xi has emphasized the chairman's role. So this would be a great stride by Mr. Xi away from collective leadership and towards strongman rule.
Well, I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're at the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on this program. You can give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to this panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Marcus Tullius Cicero. To not know what happened before one was born is to live as a child. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.